name is Kathleen. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. First, I just want to say it's really great to see such a great, huge group of young people that have a desire to change the way that they've been living, and I'm here to tell you that it really works. I want to thank Annie for asking me to come out here tonight. Annie and I got to know each other while working in some service work on the Tampa Bay Area Institutions Committee, and it was nice to see her a couple of weeks ago, and we exchanged numbers, and she called me the other night, and she says, "Oh, how you doing?" I said, "Oh, great, Annie. Good to hear from you. That's really nice." And she says, "Well, I was calling to see if you'd like to speak." Oh, Annie. She said, "That's okay. Don't worry about it. You know, I'll get someone else." Says, no, you know, I have to." She goes, "No, you don't have to." I said, "No, I have to, because my sponsor told me when anyone asks you to share your experience, strength, or hope, your answer is where and when." So I said, "Where and when?" And I said, "But you know what, Annie, just tell me that it's not a huge group." And she didn't say anything. And I said, "Annie," I said, "just tell me it's not a huge group." And she said, "Well, that all depends on what your definition of huge is. If you think huge is 500, it's not huge. But if you think 100 to 150 is huge, it's huge." Well, Annie, I think 100 to 150 is huge. I don't think there's a lot of people that like to speak, but I really don't like to speak. But I honestly believe that God works through us when we're willing to share and when we're willing to do this program. And that's why I always say yes when I'm asked to speak. My sobriety date is 4321. I had to memorize it like that because I've actually had a lot of brain damage and I really have problems with my memory. So it's April 3rd, 2001. And I was born in 1962, which I know was a long time ago for you people. Most of you weren't even alive. Growing up in the 60s and 70s was pretty radical. It was kind of crazy. I'm sure you've heard about it. It was promoted to be wild and crazy, and it was, you know, the thing to do. And my mother, great lady. I mean, she's my mother, but she's a good lady. She really wanted to instill in me, you know, to be strong and independent back when, you know, during the feminist movement. I was like the first girl in my school to wear slacks. Now, that makes me feel old. Seriously, I was the first person in my school to wear slacks. So this is what I was brought up with, you know, kind of promoting me to get out there and be controlling. I did that well. My dad, completely the most adorable, wonderful, loving man that ever existed on this earth. He loved me unconditionally from the moment I was born until the moment he passed away, and I still feel his love unconditionally. And kind of like the gentleman that was just speaking, I had a perfect life. There was nothing that I could have asked for. There was no reason for me to become an alcoholic. And my mother did not end up having issues. My parents stayed divorced until my dad passed away. Just 2 years ago, they were together every single day. I had a wonderful childhood. I had an older brother, 6 years older, and I can remember as he started his drinking career, I can remember watching him, and he was, you know, he was kind of young when he started, but I remember looking and going, "Well, that's crazy. I'm never going to be like that." And I remember making a decision at about, you know, 9 or 10 years old. I'm not going there. I was an overachiever as a young child, kind of like that gentleman that was up here. Had great grades. They came easy to me. I was perfectly organized. Turns out, and looking back, I've been OCD all my life. Another little issue that I realized. So I went about, you know, my young days thinking that everything was going to be great, not realizing that I was compulsive and obsessive, and you know, I felt like I couldn't quit anything, and to the point where the story comes to mind, my dad had bought me a piano. We were in the mall and he was like, "Oh, do you like that?" I was like, "Oh, that's great." He bought me the piano and I started taking lessons, and about 5 years later I quit. And fast forward, like I was an adult, and I said, "Oh, I always feel like a quitter." He said, "Why?" I said, "Well, I quit piano lessons." He said, "Kath, I got 5 free lessons when I bought the piano. I would have been happy if you'd taken the 5 free lessons. You went for 5 years. But yet in my mind, I'm a quitter, you know. So this overachieving, compulsive, controlling thing dates way back before any of the drinking or the drugs. So point is that there was no reason for what ended up happening in my life other than me. It was me. It wasn't my parents. It wasn't my upbringing. It wasn't my family. It wasn't anything that happened to me. And that's why I identify myself as a grateful recovering alcoholic, because had I not ended up picking up a drink and becoming obsessive with the alcohol, I would never have found this program. And I have no doubt in my mind that I'd still be wandering around this messed up little girl, just, you know, always thinking that, you know, this is the end of the world and I'm a loser, I'm a quitter, and, you know, everything has to be done to extremes, and unless I'm, like, way up here above everybody, I am just, you know, the worst thing in the world. So that would have been a lousy way to live. And although I went through a difficult 18 to 20 years of drinking and drugging, I can honestly tell you that I'm grateful for every single day that I went through, because it's made me the person that I am. I have notes here because, like I said, I did a lot of drinking and a lot of drugs, and that is my story. And I was putting off the alcohol because of the whole issue with my brother, so I kind of like conveniently substituted all the drugs. And back in the 70s, wow. Wow. I don't even remember the first time that I got high, but I quickly progressed into dealing. That's how quick it went for me. It was less than a year, and my older brother's friends were coming to me to get, you know, what I had. Again, that's just the way I've done everything. And I went through probably 3 years or so, but I don't drink. You know, I'm not like that. I'm not going to end up like that. And then I remember this gentleman or young boy that I was dating for about 2 years kept saying, "Well, why don't you have a drink?" I was like, "Nah, I don't need that. That's not me. So I finally said, "Okay, fine. Let's give this a shot." Now, mind you, my parents, you know, were very social drinkers, no problems, no issues. My brother was, you know, a drug addict, alcoholic, but it was like not in front of me. What I saw was him being brought home in the police car, you know, me going to court testifying for him, my college fund going towards his attorney's fees, that kind of stuff. So I knew it was crazy for him, but it wasn't around me. There was nobody around me in my younger life that drank, like, to extreme. But the first time I picked up alcohol, it was Pearl Harbor's, and I'll never forget that, because to this day, if I see a green drink, I kind of get sick. I drank until I vomited, and then I continued to drink until I passed out. And when I woke up at about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, I said, "Oh, it's that green stuff. I'll just make a drink and I'll omit the Midori." So I drank at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning when I woke up again. So again, right, I mean, I went right to the head. And that was the beginning of my drinking career. I started drinking right off the bat like that, and that's how I drank for several years. I was in the bars. I was, you know, it progressed very quickly to I couldn't waste my time at the bars because it was too expensive. It took too long to get a drink at the bar. It was just, you know, just a waste of my time. My time was valuable. I started just drinking at home. So I quickly progressed. It was about that time when my life was like, I mean, it was crazy. I'm from up north. At that point I was living in Boston. I was traversing the rooftops to go over to my Colombian dealer down at that end, and I had the FBI agent living on that side, watching this whole thing. I had an FBI file on me. My parents got a letter, Federal Express, and I was whisked out of the apartment in the middle of the night. The next day, this dude is on the front page of the paper. It was crazy, and I don't know how I made it through that unscathed. I honestly don't. And It was about that time that I met the guy who turned out to be my husband. He was carrying an Uzi the night that I met him. I didn't know that because he wore a long coat. He had just been released from jail for attempted murder on a judge. Get in the picture? It was extreme. But everything happens for a reason. I honestly believe that. Nothing, absolutely nothing happens in this world by mistake. God's in control. God's in charge. He knows exactly where I needed to go. I'm not saying that he did all these things to punish me, but there's a reason for everything. I don't regret anything that I've been through. Angel and I had a tumultuous relationship, and somehow we figured it out. And we both realized that we were both going to die pretty quickly if we didn't do something about it. So we just started making some agreements. No more hitting in the head. No more drinking and driving. I had run one person off the road, and to this day I don't ever know what happened to him. They ran right into a building, and I honestly don't know what happened to that person. I had several other accidents that just hit someone and just kept driving. So we made a kind of a pack, a dysfunctional sick pack, but it worked. And we got married, and we had three children. And again, I don't know how things worked out that way, but out of the blue, I just decided, you know what? I'm not going to do this stuff anymore. And I quit all drinking and drugging. And turned out 3 weeks later, I was pregnant. So what a blessing. My children were not subjected to that while I was pregnant with them. It changed our lives, having children, and we decided we were going to try to be big girls and boys and do the right thing. And, you know, that was just a, you know, part of our history, part of our, you know, little fad we went through, all that drinking and craziness. So, boy, do we have some stories to tell. But we went on, and we got some pretty decent jobs, and we bought a nice house, and we were doing the deal. And he was like, you know, the dad that went to the Girl Scout dances, and, you know, and I would crack up thinking, man, this guy, if they only knew. You know, he's covered in tattoos and earrings. And, you know, that's nice. Everybody here has lots of tattoos and earrings. But we're talking back when people didn't. You know, that was like, he's got tattoos, you know. And he had all these earrings. And this was like, if a guy had one earring, people would be like, did you see that guy? He has an earring, you know. And my ex-husband's about 6 feet and, I don't know, about this wide. And he's not fat. So he is a pretty intimidating person. But we made a nice life for ourselves. And what we did was I told him that he couldn't beat people up anymore, and he told me I couldn't drink the way I was drinking anymore. And I used to get rewarded on Friday night. He would bring home a bottle of Crown Royal, and he would make the drinks. And when he thought we were done, he would literally hide the bottle. Now, picture, we're living in this nice house in a nice town, doing the Girl Scout, you know, mom and dad, you know, all that stuff. What's wrong with that picture that he had to hide the alcohol? And, you know, all this time that I've been talking about, I never recognized that the way I was drinking or drugging was wrong. You got to remember, it's back in the 70s, in the early 80s. And lots of people did this. You know, I mean, I was working for attorneys, and they were in their office doing lines and having cocktails, and it was like the whole office would get drunk at 4 o'clock. So this was, I'm not even kidding, this was kind of normal, and I did not recognize that this was not the way everyone drank. And it was actually like socially acceptable for people to do drugs. It wasn't even a big deal. I got pulled over multiple times, and the cops would say, well, what are you doing? Well, I've just been drinking and, you know, partying and whatever. And he'd go, well, you know, enough is enough. Go home. And they would just send me home, you know. Well, I'm going to follow you and make sure you get home all right, you know. So I really didn't attribute the crazy life to the fact that I was doing it to myself and drinking and drugging and associating with Colombian drug lords and, you know, all this craziness. I just thought that's the way you did it. And even when we were living this, you know, family life and he was hiding the alcohol, it didn't dawn on me that there was something wrong with that. But then I started looking for the alcohol. I would search the house, and I would find his hiding place. And I started drinking in the middle of the afternoon when the kids were at school. And all those old feelings started welling up inside of me. Like, I can remember sitting at the end of the bed one night when he came home after work, and he knew I'd been drinking, but I guess he didn't really want to, like, admit it or, you know, recognize it. And I just said, some days I just want to get up and leave. I just, like, want to go to California and, like, just melt into the whole, you know, scene out there and just pretend like this isn't my life. I was fighting that turmoil inside. Like, you know, my drinking was being controlled for me, but in here it was just still crazy. That was the beginning of the end of our marriage. And it had been dysfunctional in the beginning, and we had kind of, like, kept it under wraps for a while, but it started getting dysfunctional again. Only this time, the little kids were there, and they were pretty small. They were, I don't know, 5, 9, and 12 or something, or I don't know. And I can remember thinking they didn't deserve this, and that my parents had provided this great atmosphere for me, and I needed to do that for them. So I made the decision to get divorced because I couldn't live with this dysfunction anymore. And since I made the decision, I regretted it because, you know, we'd been together for 15 or 16 years, and I guess I knew subconsciously that he was holding it together for me, and I knew that if he was gone, that I wouldn't exist anymore, that I would just, I thought I'd die. I didn't really know that I would go right back to the drinking, but I just didn't think that I could exist without him. So although I made the decision to get divorced, I thought this is the end of the world for me. This is not going to happen. I guess what it was really an excuse to drink. The day I asked him to leave, I had found out he'd been carrying on an affair for like a year, and you know there was beatings again coming back into the picture. So I said, that's it, you're out of here. I was on prescription Xanax. And immediately, I went down to the corner store and I bought a bottle of Crown Royal, a pack of cigarettes. I had given up smoking for like 8 years. Picked up a pack of cigarettes, the Crown Royal, and went to town. Started with the Xanax, the Crown, and the smoking. Our divorce lasted 2 years. It was horrific. It involved cops, it involved more beatings, it involved, you know, arrests and protective custody, what are they called? The restraining orders, and there was stalking, there was phone tapping, it was bad. Of course, I had an excuse to drink, right? Wouldn't you drink if you were going through all that? So although I had kind of gotten used to this life where, you know, drinking was controlled and restrained, and the drugs had gone out the window. I forgot to mention that. When we were playing family, I decided that that wasn't good for the kids. See, I think that my parents instilled in me that sense of moral values, and I really just so appreciated what my parents had done for me, I wanted to try to do the same for my kids. And so it was just enough to try to hold things together. So the drugs had gone out the window. But prescription drugs are okay because my doctor gave them to me. Well, Xanax and Crown Royal really makes a concoction. And I got taken to the hospital twice in front of my kids. I honestly don't know if it was an attempt to kill myself or just, you know, extreme behavior like I was, you know, accustomed to, or what the whole deal was, but I ended up getting taken away twice. I had the child services involved. They were coming and investigating whether or not I was a fit mother and all this. And then the funny thing was, you know, you pull up, big, beautiful house, 3 acres, 2 nice cars in the driveway, brand new Harley, you know, everything is just on the outside, just peaches and cream. On the inside, I was a mess. I was an absolute mess. That OCD stuff had really wreaked havoc in my life because what I was doing was I was overachieving still through my drinking and drugging. And I would make sure that everything in the house was spotless clean, every meeting with the kids was attended, every homework assignment was done. You know, I made more money the last year up north before I stopped drinking than I did last year. This is the first year I've actually made more money than I did that last year. I was just working my butt off, and that was because I wanted to protect my ability to drink through this divorce. You know, I thought if anybody knew that I'd reverted back to that kind of behavior, that I was falling apart, that someone would put an end to it. So I was scrambling double time. Anybody done that, you know, doing the two-step shuffle so you can make sure everything looks good and you can keep messing up over here? And so it was crazy. So in a moment of clarity, I thought, you know, I got to get out of here. So I sold the house, the divorce had come through, and I moved down here, and I was going to move in with my mom and dad with the kids and build a house, and everything would be fine. Geographic changes, you know, it's that. You know, I got to get away from the girlfriend who keeps calling and the husband who's stalking and the whole, that's why. And I showed up down here, and it wasn't but 15 days, and I was at it again. It didn't last long at all. So everything happens for a reason. Now I'm down here in my daddy's house, and it just killed me to break his heart. He still was not disappointed in me. You know, that man used to go to AA meetings with me when I first got sober. He'd do anything for me, anything. And he never said a harsh word. He never judged me. But it was killing me to make him go through this. So I'm at his house, and the ex-husband's still calling with harassing calls. This is still crazy. And I decided I can't do this. I can't live with him. I can't live without him. I can't drink anymore. I can't stop. What's the solution? I'll end my life. It seemed like the right thing. This was not a drunken stupor, stupid mistake. This was not a poor, poor, pitiful me. I'm going to do something, you know, catastrophic so everyone pays attention to me. This was a rational decision at that moment in my life. I feigned an injury to go to the hospital to get prescription medication so that I could overdose. And I didn't even drink when I took the pills because I knew if I drank and took the pills, I'd vomit and I would not die. I got in my car. I went someplace no one would ever think to look for me. I called the girlfriend that was now living with my ex-husband and having my kids over on the weekends, and I told her all those little things she needed to know about each of the kids so she could be a good mom. They were two hours away, and he gets on the phone, starts screaming at me. That's going to help. I have no idea, no clue to this day. I have no idea why I'm not dead. I took plenty of pills to kill myself, and I was gone for long enough. They had an APB out on my license plate, and the ambulance was in front of my mom's house. My dad was there. My mom was there. They were looking for, you know, any signs of me. Had gone through all my stuff in the house. I was smart. I didn't leave any clues, no trail. I wanted this to happen. Out of the blue, I have no idea how I did it. All of a sudden, my car is in the driveway right next to my mom's house, and one of the ambulance drivers says, "Aren't we looking for a black Volvo?" There I was, on the sidewalk right out in front of my mom's neighbor's house. It's like God plucked me. I'm not done with you yet, Kath. You got a purpose. So they took me over to the hospital, and I got Baker-acted. And the sick thing, I don't know why, it's weird things that pop in your mind. I was so happy that I had just had my hair cut. Because I was like, oh, I'm going to be here for a while. They took away all sharp objects and my shoestrings, and I had to eat with a spoon for a while. And that was the first time in 2 years that I wasn't drunk. 2 years straight. I had ballooned up to about 180 pounds. I wasn't eating anymore. I was only drinking. I was brushing my teeth and vomiting. I couldn't even have a toothbrush in my mouth. I was defecating blood. I was shutting down. I was trying to kill myself slowly. That wasn't working quick enough, so I took the pills. I can remember that I was in that emergency room, and I could see my dad through the glass wall, and oh man, it broke my heart. And that nurse climbed up on my chest and was jamming that tube down my throat or my nose or whatever it was. I wasn't really sure. And she was saying, you're not worth the trouble you're causing. And I can remember thinking, how dare you? Now here I am, I want to be dead. But who are you to insult me? So I did all kinds of things in there. I pretended to cooperate. I said, no, I'll drink the charcoal. I'll do it. And then she'd turn around and I'd spill it. So, I mean, I was just trying to delay, thinking, five more minutes, and all the medication will start shutting down my organs. And, you know, I mean, because I was out, and then I had these moments of, you know, consciousness. So even then, I'm still trying to control the situation. At any rate, obviously, I was not successful, and she was. But I'll tell you what, she stuck in my head for a long time that I wasn't worth the trouble that I was causing. I started thinking about that. And I ended up being in this lockdown ward up in Newport Richey, and I met, you know, one of the social workers, and he was willing to share his experience, strength, and hope with me. Now, backing up a little bit, through the course of the divorce, my dad had flown up 3 or 4 times, you know, when I had been sent to the hospital for these potential overdoses and attempted suicides, and he had said, you know, have you thought about going to AA? And I said, well, you know, I don't need AA. I know I'm an alcoholic, and isn't AA just admitting that you're an alcoholic? So, anyways, I talked to this guy in the hospital there, and he started saying things, and he was able to say things that I identified with about the OCD and all these problems and all this stuff in his head, and it wasn't about the drinking. It was about this stuff. And I reluctantly agreed to go to an AA meeting in there, and he kind of challenged me. Remember, I'm not a quitter and I'm not a loser, and he kind of challenged me, and he goes, yeah, everybody says they're going to go to AA, but no one ever shows up on a meeting on the outside. So, of course, I had to show up to prove him wrong. But that was one of the best choices that I had made in my life. So I started going to meetings, and after a couple of days of being locked up and, you know, being cleared out, it dawned on me, what the heck are you doing with your life? This is crazy. Besides that, you can't even kill yourself, so you're going to have to do something different. This isn't working. So I showed up, and I started listening, and I took every suggestion seriously. I didn't half-ass anything. But there you go, OCD comes in handy, because now I started using it for positive things. And I took all my sponsor's suggestions, and I can remember her saying in the beginning, don't quit until the miracle happens. And I was still stressing, and I was still struggling, and I honestly don't remember how long that went on for. But I remember one day I realized I couldn't think of the last time I had thought about a drink. I really had no idea. Had it been a couple of days or a couple of weeks? But I wasn't thinking about a drink. I was thinking about how many meetings I could get to today, and if I could get to the gym at 5 o'clock in the morning, I could make the 7 o'clock meeting, and then I could go drop off the kids at school, and then I could go back to the noontime meeting, and then I could... OCD does well for certain things. But seriously, I mean, anything too extreme, even my positive compulsions can be a problem. So today, that's what I deal with, is trying to control my compulsions, whether it's coffee, M&Ms, the gym, shopping, working, cleaning. I really have a problem with anything that takes me out of my own head, I get obsessed with. But at least they're positive things now. I took all my sponsor's suggestions seriously, and I just want to point out what she showed me. 1 through 3 got me sober, and there's no doubt about that. And step 1 was the only thing that I had to do perfectly. I need to ease up on myself and just work on everything else. Just work on the rest of the steps. I had to do them in order. But she reminded me that 1 through 3 will get you sober, and 4 through 10 will keep you sober. But if you shortchange 11 and 12, you're going to shortchange your serenity, and you're going to be susceptible to a relapse. And most people that I talk to that have relapsed really didn't pay much attention to 11 and 12. For me, 11 and 12 is what I live by. yeah, sure, okay, everybody says that. You know, you go through the steps and then you continuously take inventory. But for me, service work and my conscious contact with God has been what has not only kept me sober, but has kept me happy to be alive. I don't get up anymore and think, every single day, no matter what's going on in my life, I am thrilled to be alive. I can't believe that I'm not dead. Between the stuff I was doing in Boston, I should have been dead. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I woke up, didn't even know where I was. I know a lot of you have done that, so you know what I'm talking about. But then the attempted suicides and all the other situations I put myself in, not to mention just my health. I mean, I can't believe I don't have any health issues. My liver's fine. To be alive today is a blessing. So I work 11 and 12 on a daily basis. And for me, service work is key. Because, you know, in your sobriety, you go through that pink cloud thing, and then when that bursts, where are you? And then, you know, you start coming up on a couple of years, and you start realizing, is this all there is? And, you know, I know too many people that after 7 years just said, well, you know, they just kind of wandered away. Service work has kept me grounded. I can think of many times, looking back, that, you know, I kind of wasn't really keeping in touch with my sponsor on a daily basis. Oh, I know what she's going to say. I don't need to talk to her. And the meetings, you get frustrated. Oh, this one says that, and they always go off on topic, and I'm not going to go anymore, and I get a resentment and all that crap. And, yeah, I work through it. But what has kept me grounded and connected has been service work. And I can't emphasize that enough. And yeah, that's fine in the beginning when service work for you is greeting or coffee or, you know, ashtrays or whatever. And that's good. It makes you feel a part of and needed, and you are. But just like, you know, anything else in life, you have to expand on it and grow with it and go further with it and make yourself available. And when anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I am responsible. And I take that seriously. I am responsible. Not we, not you, not AA. I am responsible. So I have been going to the jails for 8 years now. Because at my 1 year anniversary, an announcement was made. Anyone wanted to volunteer in jails to see this person after the meeting? And my sponsor said, that would be you. And she has not told me to stop yet. I've taken on different aspects of the jail meetings. At one time I was going in twice a week. Now I'm coordinating the meetings to make sure that they're covered. But if I had not been involved and committed to some type of service work, I know for a fact that I would have wandered away. And as far as step 11, you know, when I got up there, it was like a revelation when I came into this program, because I had, I'd been raised Catholic, and I don't want to insult anybody, but I consider myself a recovering Catholic, and I really don't want to insult anybody. But that caused a lot of problems for me. I had a lot of issues with the whole God thing and the whole religion thing, and when I came in and I heard about the God of your understanding, and I wasn't told who or what or how or, you know, what the face looked like or anything, that was like such a relief to me that I was able to just say, oh, my perception is okay. But that only worked in the beginning. My sponsor told me that, don't worry about the God thing. All you have to know is you're not God. And that worked. But when I got up around step 11 and I was getting that antsy, you know, whatever, I need to tweak my program, I looked at it and I read it for what it says. Sought. Seek. Seek and you shall find. For me, I went to a bunch of different churches because, you know, there are professionals on the outside that we may need to seek help from too. And religions aren't necessarily a bad, nasty word. Churches aren't man-made necessarily. So I set aside all my misconceptions and all my perceptions, and I started going to a bunch of different churches until I found the one that felt right for me. I took Christ as my Savior, and I'm actively involved in my church now. And I'll tell you what, all those years of going to church, I never heard anything the way I hear it now. And what it is, it's all program. Because this is a God program. And I sit there in church, and my pastor tells me the same things that my sponsor tells me, only much nicer. And so for me, I'm not pushing anything on you. As long as it's a God of your understanding and you continue to seek that conscious contact with that God, that for me was one of the greatest gifts of many that AA has given me, was to be able to put aside those issues that I had, because I'd been holding on to some serious issues about church for years. And that God hole, you know, even though AA was helping me to fill it, it was an insult for me to hold on to ideals that had, you know, they were just misconceptions from when I was a kid. So today, I continue to do my service work. I continue to have a daily conscious contact with Christ, my Savior. I ask for help every single morning. Every single morning for the last 9.5 years, I am petrified to start my day without asking for help, because I don't know what's going to happen when I walk out. And I want to have as much ammunition in my back pocket as possible. And I know with God all things are possible. So every single morning I ask him very simply, God, grant me the knowledge of your will and the power to carry it out. And every single day when I get ready for bed, I don't have any problem remembering it. I don't know why. It's one of those things that's just, it's so natural to me. I get on my knees and I thank God for another day, because no matter what has happened, if I am drawing a breath, it's been a blessing. And I can honestly tell you that even losing my dad 2 years ago, one of the things that I had been dreading the most was just, it was okay. Because everything happens for a reason, and God never makes any mistakes. And when I complain about a person, place, thing, or situation, I'm saying I know better than God. I'm complaining about God's handiwork. So that's how I live my life today. And for anyone that hasn't given this way of life a try yet, or is still having some problems, one of my favorite little sayings is, and I have to read it because I never remember, there is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is a proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. And I'm here to tell you that this program is worth giving it a shot and worth investigating. Thank you for having me.
Where is it? My name's Jim. I'm an alcoholic. This is Dr. Bob's last message. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this, with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months, and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is. So let's bear those 2 things in mind. Let us also remember God, that erring member of the tongue. And if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us. to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency so that we are not willing to extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.